Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Mary Tabor, the author of the novel Who by Fire. My guest today is Molly Peacock. If you've ridden the subway or bus in a major city, you already might know her because she is one of the founders of Poetry in Motion, lines of verse that you, like me, have savored and been saved by on crowded commutes. Molly Peacock, poet extraordinaire, has published 6 volumes of poetry, including my much-beloved The Second Blush, and the wonderful book, How to Read a Poem and Start a Poetry Circle. Her poems have appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, The New Republic, The Times Literary Supplement, and more literary magazines than I can name. And if you're not impressed yet, know this. She wrote The Paper Garden, a delicious, gorgeous book about the artist Mary Delaney, who began her life's work, the creation of exquisite mosaics of flowers, at age 72. The Paper Garden began as an essay, Passion Flowers in Winter, about Mary Delaney and about Molly Peacock's mother, and that was chosen by the late David Foster Wallace for Best American Essays. I was dumbstruck by The Paper Garden. Already in love with Molly, I fell hard again, as if I'd come home, as if I'd known her all my life, though we've never met or talked until today. This book changed my way of looking at the creative world and my own attempts to create art. The Paper Garden is not only a telling of the remarkable life of Mary Delaney, it also seamlessly braids, weaves, integrates into that telling Molly, the author, the person, and might I say, the spirit. We discover Molly's insights on creativity, on art, on love, indeed on the art of living. Molly, a heartfelt welcome to Rare Bird Radio.
Wow, Rare Bird Radio just gave me an incredible introduction, and as someone with the last name of a bird, I really feel very, very, very welcomed indeed.
And you are a bird in more ways than one, are you not? Are you still flying between Toronto and New York, by the way?
No, I make Toronto my permanent home. I'm an expat New Yorker who lives in Canada, but I'm a dual citizen of both countries. And for many years, I did go back and forth between New York City and Toronto, but we pulled up stakes from New York and live exclusively in Canada, except for our secret winter sublet. We're always down in February and March, where both my husband and I teach at the 92nd Street Y Unterberg Poetry Center.
Oh, wow. Wonderful. My goodness. I didn't know that. That's a new fact about you that's fascinating.
You get out of that cold Canadian
weather.
Yeah, we call New York our Florida.
Well, after Canada, I guess that's appropriate. Molly, I'd like to focus today on The Paper Garden and its flowers, so we may go elsewhere as well, to pollinate a conversation about creativity and art and life. For those listening live, we will take questions for Molly about 20 minutes into that conversation. Molly, I'd like to begin with the kind of the question of technique for anyone doing any kind of work, actually, whether it be, I think all work is creative in some sense. And we do know that Mrs. Delaney had some 200 petals and maybe just one bloom of a flower. In the book, you say something that I'd like you to talk about. You must have technical skill to accomplish anything, but you also must have passion, which in an odd way is technique forgotten. Tell me about that.
Yes, I do think that you have to have technical skill in order to accomplish art, and Mrs. Delaney certainly had fabulous technique. And I'm going to stop and tell everyone who Mrs. Delaney is. Because
not
everybody knows her as well as you and I do. Mrs. Delaney, at the age of 72, in 1772, invented the art of collage. I know that your art history books tell you that Matisse and Picasso invented collage in the 20th century, but in fact, during the Revolutionary War era, but in England, Mary Delaney, Mary Pendarvis, Mary Granville Pendarvis Delaney, creating her cut paper botanicals. She would take hundreds and hundreds of little dots, squiggles, bits of color, brightly colored paper, and compose botanically accurate portraits of flowers on dramatic black backgrounds.
Oh, go ahead. But they're so gorgeous. Let me just say, they're so gorgeous. You've got to get the book if you're listening. You've got to get the book.
Because, this book is part art book, part literary book, because the illustrations are so beautifully reproduced. Because I felt so strongly that people needed to see this incredible work, because she's not well-known in North America. And the other thing you need to know about Mary Delaney is that she did not begin this enterprise until she was 72 years old. So that the whole impulse behind the book for me was trying to figure out what happened in this woman's life that allowed her to spring into this level of creativity at such an advanced age.
Well, before I come back to the question I posed initially, this raises something for me that I have a question that's been emailed to me or posted on my on one of my sites, and the question is, what was your inspiration to actually go after Mary Delaney? How did you find her?
I found her at the Morgan Library in 1986. I was a seventh grade teacher at Friends Seminary School in New York City in Manhattan. And
what were you teaching?
What was I teaching? I was teaching English. I was teaching English, and I'm happy to say I'm still in touch with some of my middle school students who have become writers. Rebecca Wolfe, the fabulous poet, was one of my students. John Reed, the spectacular fiction writer, was not one of my students, but he was at Friends Seminary at the time, and we're in touch. There are many, many Friends Seminary people who were 12-year-olds running around doing all of my crazy creative writing assignments then. And
well, you sound like a wonderful teacher. So you discover her,
I went up to the Morgan Library on a Saturday afternoon, and I was supposed to be at the Museum of Modern Art, looking at abstract, more contemporary art. But instead, I fell into the world of an 18th century woman who did not think of herself as an artist. She was an amateur. And all of her life, she was engaged in artistic activity, not under some sort of pressure to publish, to show them, to do anything other than for her own enrichment, her own entertainment, and her own uses. It was seeing those things that just... I thought, my gosh, my grandmother. She's my grandmother's age when she started doing this. And I raced to the bookstore of the Morgan Library, thinking I would buy the book that went along with it, and discovered it was a very expensive British hardcover import, and that I had this lowly middle school Quaker school salary, and I had to make my rent, and I thought, well, I'm going to give this book a pass, and so I did, and I left to the Morgan Library, and I thought about Mary Delaney periodically, but was, you know, caught up in the maelstrom of life, as everyone is. And but in 2003, I re-encountered her.
And was that in Ireland?
That was in London at
that was
the
in
British
London.
Museum.
Ah.
Yes, but I was when I first saw them, I was what I think of now as a baby poet, just beginning to establish myself as a poet and be really think of myself as an artist. And but by 2003, my husband, who is a James Joyce scholar, his name is Michael Groden, and I were invited to Oxford to give he gave a talk and I gave a reading, and we came to London after Oxford and stopped at the British Museum, and this is just before international cell phones, so my husband went to make a phone call, in this phone booth, and he was there, and I was waiting and waiting, and to occupy myself, I walked into the gift shop. Over the lintel of the gift shop, it says the Granville Room. I had no idea, of course, that Mrs. Delaney was a Granville at the time, but I went in, and he was on the phone
meaning
so
her name,
long.
Meaning her name, Granville. Her name,
yes,
Granville.
Mm-hmm. Her family name. And while he was on the phone, I worked my way through the gift shop, and at the last table, there was the book I couldn't afford in 1986.
And the size
so
of
these,
do I have this right, that the size of these mosaics, that they're in 10 volumes, there are, the total is about 985
yes.
mosaics, but they're about 2 feet tall, right? I mean, they're big.
They, you know, they're really, the volumes themselves, she made these and put them, interleaved them into large leather-bound folios, ten folios, because she was aiming for 1,000. It only made it to 985. Don't sigh. She had a vision, and she met her vision, if not her goal. But the actual works vary in size. Many of them are about the size of a piece of typewriter paper.
Really?
Some smaller than that. So
wow.
8.5 by 11, she put borders around them and then interleaved them into these large folios. But not that many of them. Not very many at all would be as large as 2 feet.
Oh, okay. You know, so we're talking about a 72-year-old. You're saying in many ways an amateur, not somebody who's known for her craft as you now are. So let me come back to this question about where she learned her technique and what does technique
yes.
have to do with creation, in your view, for your work and for Mary's work?
Okay, that's a really fascinating question. I think that technique guides us, and I think that technique is what we have a choice over when we make art. I don't think we necessarily have a choice of our subject. I think our subject seizes us. Even if we make art to such a level of abstraction that there doesn't appear to be a subject, if we are bent on annihilating some subjects, even so, those impulses, I think, come from very deep inside us, and we don't often have a choice about them. But technique involves choices. Technique is craft, and technique is conscious. And
Is there something else that's needed on top of that technique for that technique to become art, though?
Well, sure. I think for me, the best art combines passion and virtuosity.
Ah, there we go. I'll take those as watchwords.
Yeah. Well, when I'm talking about technique, I'm talking about that impulse that we all have. When you get into something, you have to be into it. But whether you're into creating the most beautiful birch canoes, or whether you're totally into playing the guitar, or whether you your life is incomplete without doing dancing, it depends on what seizes you. Even collectors, say you're just you've got money at your disposal, you're amassing an art collection, that requires technique. And poetry is a heavily technique laden art.
In terms of prosody, would you say, are you talking about prosody at this
yes,
point?
Yes, I'm talking about prosody
so
with poetry.
For those who don't know that word, for the sort of the rules of poetry,
yes.
Like what makes a villanelle?
Yes, I'm talking about the rules, about the metrical rules, about
mm-hmm.
what you can do,
mm-hmm.
about rhyming, whether you want to make that obvious, whether you want to bury it. I'm talking about music, imagery, metaphor, all the things that scare you when you have to take a high school test on poetry terms, but the things that can delight you if you actually
yeah.
come to it through your intuition and not through something that's over-intellectualized. But the technique is the craft element. A technique rescues you. Because there are things that you want to say. You have a vision in your head. Everybody out there who's tried to make anything knows how hard it is to take the vision that they have and replicate that in some way, whether that's a musical manifestation of it or a poem or a drawing or any form of expression, what you've got in your head and what comes out, there's a big distance between them. But technique
manages that
distance.
You also, Molly, talk about in the book the need for Mary Delaney, but I think perhaps for you too, I'd like you to talk about it in terms of yourself as well, the need to find time. Let me put it in Mary Delaney's terms, and then I'd like you to put it in your terms. You say she was beginning to be abrupt with people in order to do her work and showed
yes.
the incivility of the artist at work and what others call selfishness. And I'd like you to
yes.
talk about this because I fear this myself. And if you could talk about this for those of us who are trying to create or attempting any creative activity, what does this mean? How do you see this?
When you make art, you are self-absorbed. And making art requires time, and it requires you to say no to people in order to create that space in your life. You need to create the space in order to create. And when Mary Delaney, of course, this is not, there weren't even telephone calls. People just dropped in,
Yeah,
besieged.
Yeah.
She was a minister's wife, so she had to be available to everybody.
But she really didn't begin creating till he died, right?
Well, no. I mean, she didn't begin her great work till after he died. But she was always
yeah.
painting and doing. She did a lot of artwork, just not to the magnificence that she did it after the age of 72. But in terms of being selfish, you must make a claim for yourself. And that's different from being selfish. Being selfish is being narcissistically self-absorbed and not recognizing that there's anybody else in the world but you, 24/7 in your life. But to stake out a claim for your silence, for your quietness, for a still point in your life so that you can create something is an act of nurturing the self. But not everyone around you recognizes that, because you are almost always.
You do need some help with that, don't you? I mean, isn't approval also key? One of the things you say in the book that really struck me was, I won't explain exactly where this occurs, but right then Mary Delaney's friend of more than 40 years supplied exactly what was necessary, applause. Now, nobody really talks about this. Writers are all busy in the solitary, you know, up in the attic, and I don't need anybody, I just need to create. Do we need applause? And how does it work for us?
Yes, every artist needs applause, and every artist needs a friend. And, I mean, we labor under this ridiculous idea that art is made as in a solitary fashion all alone, and it's not true. We need approval. We need response. And it helps us go on. And even Emily Dickinson needed the approval of her sister-in-law as she pinned her poems to her nieces and nephews who would take them to her sister-in-law for her response. I mean, all artists tap into an interior voice or an interior vision and then put it out for the world. And Mary Delaney and our friends are crucial. If Mary Delaney's friend had not walked in upon her creating her very first, what she calls her first flower mosaic, and said, "Wow, what are you doing? This is amazing," I don't know whether she would have gone on.
And
it was
how
that
about
friend's approbation that sparked her.
And how about
and get
for
this.
You?
Excuse me,
can
how
I
about
ask
for
about,
me?
Yeah,
oh,
you
yeah.
Can. How about for
no,
you?
No, absolutely. There's two things I want to say. One is, in terms of carving out time and asserting your power over what you need to do in terms of making your art, I have mm-hmm. to say that I laid on my therapist's couch for years weeping and trying to figure out how I could be an artist and make a living and have relationships and be a daughter and be a wife and it's an art in itself trying to figure this out. So that's one thing. And your husband
has he been a real? I gather that he has been a real
supporter.
Can
he's
you talk
fabulous.
About this a little
he's
bit?
He's fabulous. But folks, this is the second marriage. We were 45 when we got married, so I really knew who I was. I mean, I was a published author. It's different when you're not. And I think it certainly took its toll on my very young first marriage, as I was trying to figure all this out.
Well, love is key, though, in the process, don't you think? I mean, in some way, doesn't love come into play for the art? For you to be loved has helped you to create so much, and you've been so prolific.
No, I do think to be loved and to be supported, and that can have many manifestations. But to have people around you who are supporting what you do, I think is key, because there's a tremendous amount of rejection for any artist at any level. There's always somebody who has some negative opinion of what you're doing, and you've got to be able to withstand that, and you've got to be able also to understand it. I mean, maybe they have a point, and you've got to take that in too, and you need the support in order to do that. Oh, my gosh.
And I want to talk about something that I think nobody, not very many people, not very many writers and artists talk about this, but is there something spiritual that needs to happen to you as well? I mean, I'm not asking you to talk about your so-called, you know, whatever you would call your religion. This is really a question, Molly, about the search for meaning and the spiritual connection that the artist may feel in some way. I mean, this is the, you know, the sort of, it's kind of a mojo question in a way, you know, like where does this all come from? Do you think about this? Do you talk about this in your own head?
I do a bit, and I'll go back to Mrs. Delaney for a minute. I mean, Mrs.
Yeah.
Delaney, of course, was, I mean, she was a devout Christian of her day. She was married to Dean Patrick Delaney, who was a friend of Dean Jonathan Swift. And for Mrs. Delaney, the idea of God's universe, God's world revealing itself in all of its dazzling mystery in a flower, in a tree, in the eye of an animal, all of that was kind of a continuing revelation for her. And I can't say that I am traditionally religious in that way,
yep.
But in the respect of really looking at something, really noticing, and Mrs. Delaney was a noticer, and my own noticing of the world resonates with her and with what she did. If you really look at whatever is in the natural world or whatever is man-made, simply the act of observing, to me, seems to be a spiritual act. When you
to me
don't
too.
Understand
I
a
so,
thing.
I so think that's so, and I was so touched by it in the book. This book has touched me so many ways. One of the lines that's very close to, I think, what you're talking about the sheer joy of observing the world as it is, as you've said, you say
mm-hmm.
direct examination leads to direct epiphany, which brings me back to that word you used of revelation. Can you talk
yes.
a little bit about that?
Yes, because simply focusing, just concentrating, and concentration actually is a big thing for us in 21st century life. We're distracted more than ever. So actually to be able to focus brings all of our senses and our awarenesses together. It keeps us whole, and we have a sense of ourselves as a whole human being perceiving the world. And I think that comes out of a certain degree of quiet, a certain degree of stillness of the self. And I don't mean an extravagant stillness. I'm not talking to you, you know, in terms of gurus or yogis or anything like that.
Right, right.
Just simply sound like a moment, you know, a moment. While you're eating your granola in the morning, that kind of a moment where you just are focused on
And to give you, Molly, an inelegant quote, then I hope will be a little more elegant quote because I'm going to quote you. but the inelegant quote is from Yogi Berra, "It ain't over till it's over." We're talking here about a woman who at 72 and between 72
yeah.
and 82 started over. You put it this way: some of us flash into floral peak like prom queens, but others of us have to dry like the winter cherry, which is the name of one of her mosaics, in order to unfold into productivity. So what do you think about those of us who are older and who are trying to begin or emerging and are not 25 and not
okay, I'm going to tell you what this is what I learned from studying the life of Mary Delaney, who she died at the age of 88, incidentally. What I learned, people would say to me, oh, well, if she didn't have that horrible first marriage, she was practically sold to this man her grandfather's
yes.
age.
Oh,
if she didn't have this other thing happen, if the second husband wasn't ill, if this didn't happen, if she didn't live in the sexist society, blah, 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 she would have created earlier. And I say to you, that is not the case. Some things I learned take living long enough to do.
Oh,
she
that's
couldn't.
A beautiful line.
She couldn't.
Such a beautiful
thank
line.
You. Thank you. Thanks. It's something that came out of me because it's something that I learned from tracking all of those instances of creativity in her life. You cannot There is art that cannot be made at any time in a life before it is made. So if you are out there and you are 80 and you are drawing something or writing something and saying to yourself, "Oh, I should have done this earlier," I'm saying to you, no. You are doing this at the moment you were meant to be doing it in your life. That there are vectors of experience and circumstance that have come together now. And so the whole concept of late blooming, it's a nice concept. I like it, but I'm stymieing myself.
I think
we grow till the minute we die. There are ways in which we have capacities to surprise ourselves till very, very late in our lives. Now, illness erodes that, and all of us who've been ill at various times in our lives, who are ill, we understand that pain erodes that, age erodes it, but there are these ways in which, just because of that spirituality you and I were talking about,
yes,
just because
Molly,
of that noticing.
As a late bloomer myself, I'd like you to know how much you have encouraged me, how much this book has given me hope in my own work. And I'd like to bring this show to a close with a quote from you, something you actually say in the book that I think is so beautiful, and I hope you will forgive me for sort of adapting it to my own purposes here, because, Molly, this has been such an incredible conversation with you. You say you can't step twice into the same river. Heraclitus reminds us, but there is that moment when jumping into the rapids of time, two people surface together. Molly Peacock, I'd like to say to you, and I'd like to think, that I have stepped into the rapids of time, surfaced, and that, Molly Peacock, you and I have connected.
I absolutely feel that from this wonderful conversation, Mary. I'm so glad to be bobbing up in the rabbits of time and finding you there on this interview and with our correspondences. And I just wish you heaps of success with your own writing and as you launch into the publication of your first novel.
Thank you, Molly, so much. And with that, we will close the show, and I send my best wishes to you. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for everything you've written. I feel rescued by you, and would say from a poem by you that you say certain people take, this is a poem from The Second Blush, certain people take huge pride in keeping others alive, and I was one of these. Molly, you have given me courage. You've rescued me. Molly Peacock, thank you for a beautiful show.
Mary Tabor, thank you. I'm so pleased to have participated in this with you. Thanks again.
Goodbye, Molly.
Bye.
Turn to gold. I thought I had everything. Now I'm left without a hand to hold. But it's all right, I'm okay. How are you? For what it's worth, I must say, I love you.
everything around me turns to rust. It's 'cause I built my life on sand, and I watched it crumble in the dust. Yeah, but it's alright, I'm okay. I wanna know how you are and what it's. But everything around me turned around. But I know all I have to do is sing. And I lift myself way off the ground.